Everyone, this is Jordan.
And I'm Maya.
And today we'll be going over the rest of the events of the last week.
Yeah, this is the second part of our two-part series on the events of the last week that the brothers said led to them killing their parents. So definitely check out our first part before starting this episode. Trigger warning for this episode, we'll be briefly discussing sexual abuse as well as talking about death slash killing people.
Hey, the next day was the Friday, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
According to Eric, the Friday morning, I think he was practicing tennis, like maybe serves and stuff like that, just to get his mind off of like what was actually happening. And then Lyle comes out and then reminds him that like they can't forget about what's actually happening and that they need to defend themselves somehow just in case. So then after that, the brothers then go to a gun store in Santa Monica. But according to them, they learn that there's a 2-week waiting period for handguns and that they can only get shotguns over the counter.
We went to buy handguns that we could carry around and weren't able to do that.
Why not?
Well, we went there and we inquired about the handguns and I don't remember that big five as well, but basically we were in the process of trying to pick a handgun and buy one, and then we were told that we weren't going to be able to leave the store with them, that it took 2 weeks, a waiting period where they would have to check our credentials and they do this mandatory check. We'd have to wait 2 weeks and come back. And so that was, we hadn't known that, and we just sort of, he told us the only thing you can buy over the counter is rifles, shotguns. So we just left pretty much confused.
Why wasn't it going to be good enough to get them in 2 weeks?
Well, clearly we could not wait 2 weeks, and that I really felt that my dad was going to act, that either he would act very quickly or my mom would make something happen fast. We weren't going to have a lot of time, because I did feel my dad thought I was going to tell people. But in any case, we would never have waited. We wanted to get the protection right away.
This leads us into one of like the more controversial parts of the trial, you could say.
Yeah, so what the brothers said happened was that they had gone to a Big Five in Santa Monica. Big Five is like a sporting goods store that sells guns. However, on cross-examination, one of the prosecutors, Kuriyama, confronted Eric with the fact that Big Five had stopped selling handguns 2 or 3 years before the brothers said they had gone to the store. So, like, there was no way that they could have been looking at handguns in a Big Five.
You're telling the truth about everything in this case, aren't you?
I'm telling the truth to the best that I can.
Okay. And even though you've lied in the past, you're telling the truth now, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Did you truly go to the Santa Monica Big Five store on the morning of August 18th to buy these handguns?
Definitely. And without a doubt, I did.
You and Lyle did?
Yes.
And you and Lyle actually looked in this case and you selected these guns and you were told you couldn't leave the store with those handguns because there's a 15-day wait.
Yes.
Mr. Menendez, did you know that Big Five stopped carrying handguns in March of 1986?
No, I don't know that. Mr. Kuriyama, there were guns there, and we did look at them, and he did say we could not carry them anymore.
Now,
this moment is kind of referred to as what's called a Perry Mason moment, which is where, like, there's like a gotcha moment, like, aha, you're not telling the truth. It's definitely one of the more, like, famous moments from this trial, I'd say.
Yeah. What usually doesn't get covered when this gotcha moment is presented in documentaries is that there were, like, a few explanations presented during trial as to why Eric was either mistaken about this, or he was misremembering, or thinking about a different store.
Well, I think the first thing to remember is that the trial happened 4 years after these events.
The gun purchase, yeah. So this was 4 years prior. So that already would make your memory a bit shaky on, like, the names of places. Eric also had something called dysnomia, which is a language disorder. It affects, like, memory and remembering, like, names of places and people and locations. So on top of it being 4 years prior, Eric also had a disorder which made it harder for him to remember names.
I mean, this is really the only time that either of the brothers were, like, caught out, or, like, there was some inconsistency with their story. I think that it probably was just that they had gone to a different store. Like, it wasn't a Big Five, it was a different store, because it was only Big Five that didn't sell handguns. I think they brought up that there were, like, a number of gun stores in the area. My opinion is that they probably had just gone to a different store and had this interaction, and it just wasn't a Big Five.
Yeah. The defense brought in someone to essentially explain, and I think they presented pictures as well of, I think it was the Big Five, and that they did actually sell fake handguns, I believe.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like another explanation as to why Eric would, like, misunderstand or, like, get the stores confused, because at the Big Five they did sell fake handguns.
I don't know. My view on this is that I think it gets blown way out of proportion, especially considering that this wasn't even the store that they ended up buying the guns at. What's the point of him lying about this being a Big Five or having this, you know, interaction at all, considering that there was no way to know that they had even gone to this store because they didn't buy anything?
Oh yeah, there would be no record of them being there, yeah. I mean, I think it's also the sort of thing where it's like, if it was like some made-up story concocted by their lawyers, that seems like such like a weird thing to lie about in the first place, but then also, wouldn't the lawyers have just, like, double-checked, like, with that specific store before saying that? Do you sort of know what I'm saying?
Yeah. For some reason, a lot of people seem to think that the entire defense was created by Leslie Abramson. I don't think that she would have been that stupid.
Yeah.
Like, if you're gonna create your defense for your client like that, and then to not actually go to the store and see if this is something that is possible.
I mean, and the defense had the resources to double check stuff like this as well, didn't they? Had, like, multiple private investigators as well that worked for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, aside from that, it's just such an inconsequential, like, part of the story, if you want to call it that. So, like, I don't think it really makes a difference either way.
Yeah, I think it just gets, like, brought up so much because it's really the only time that there was an inconsistency.
Yeah, that's true.
And so they're like, ha-ha, like, we got you, you lied. But, like, I really don't think it makes sense that it was a lie. I don't think it makes sense that Eric would have intentionally lied about this, considering the way that it fits into the overall story. And there's a very valid explanation for why he was probably just mistaken, considering that he had literally been diagnosed with a disorder that would cause him to mix up the names of places.
And combine that with visiting multiple gun stores 4 years prior.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, the next is the drive to San Diego, right?
Yeah, so after they learned that they couldn't buy handguns, according to the brothers, they didn't really know what to do. So they decided to just kind of drive around because they didn't really want to be in the house. So they decided to eventually drive down to San Diego, which is about a 2-hour drive from LA. They ended up buying guns in San Diego. And a lot of people talk about this as, like, them trying to conceal that they were buying these guns, and, oh, they drove to a whole other city, so, like, obviously they were trying to, you know, hide the fact that they were buying the murder weapon.
Their explanation for it was that they just didn't want to go home, and so they were just driving around, and they ended up in San Diego, which is, I don't know, like, is that, like, a place where, like, a lot of young people go to, like, hang out or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, it's a beach town. I mean, I don't really know. I'm from California, but I'm from Northern California, so I don't really know what, like, whether people in LA go to San Diego a lot, but it is a different vibe. I would say, like, more chill.
Yeah. They also had family that lived there, right? I know that. So it wasn't like an entirely like foreign place to them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is one of the parts of the story where it's like, it's either they were just driving around and they ended up in San Diego, which is what they said, or they were trying to conceal their purchase of guns. But I don't know. It could go either way for me. I feel like when you take it, when you look at it on its own, it definitely does look a bit sus, if you want to say that. But I feel like when you look at the whole picture of the story of like the events of the last week and then all the corroboration for other parts of that story, if you look at it within that, it does make a lot more sense as to why they would have just ended up there, because they didn't want to go home.
So on the drive to San Diego, Eric started to tell Lyle more details about the sexual abuse, including that Jose had like threatened to kill him if he told anyone. Specifically, he had threatened to kill him if he told Lyle, and he threatened to kill Lyle if Eric told Lyle. And this kind of made Lyle realize how serious the situation was, and that the threats that Jose had implied to him were probably real. Once they got to San Diego, they were like, we really need to buy guns. Like, we really need to protect ourselves. So they went to another gun store. And there they learned that they needed California identification to buy a gun in California. At the time, neither brother had a valid California ID in their names. So the defense produced documents that showed that Lyle had a California and a New Jersey license, but his California license had been suspended, and Eric had lost his license, which was shown because he had gotten a ticket, I think, like in May of 1989, that was for driving without a license.
Yeah, I believe it was at the second store where, like, after they learned about needing California identification, because they'd been, like, hovering around for a while and, like, talking, they thought that, like, the store owners would think it would be, like, a bit suspicious, so they decided to leave. And then that's where they decided, like, oh, okay, like, you can just use Donovan's ID.
Yeah, so to explain how they got Donovan's ID, you have to back up a little bit, because it tends to be construed that Lyle stole Donovan's ID. So Lyle and Donovan were best friends at Princeton. But then Jose found out that Donovan was kind of a con man and he wasn't really a Princeton student. And Jose forced Lyle to end their friendship. But Donovan had left his ID in Lyle's dorm room because he was like basically living there. And Jose forced Lyle to kick Donovan out, but Donovan left his ID in Lyle's dorm room, and then Lyle gave Donovan's ID to Eric because Eric was under 21, which is the legal drinking age in the U.S., because Donovan was over 21. Eric kept Donovan's ID in his wallet as, like, a fake ID to get into clubs and bars and stuff. But he actually had another fake ID, which was in the name of Richard Stevens. It was, like, something that, I guess, kids at his high school, like, made fake IDs where it had, like, you're, like, 22 or whatever, and it has your face and a fake name on it.
Wasn't that the ID that, like, Kitty made for them? Because I remember that's part of Kirsten Smith's testimony.
Yeah.
Because I think they were, like, going out somewhere and Eric needed a fake ID. And then Kitty, like, did it for him. But, like, the Richard Stevens ID is the sort of thing where, like, if they were really trying to conceal their identity, why didn't Eric just use the Richard Stevens ID?
Yeah, they didn't bring the Richard Stevens ID because I guess Eric had, like, kept it in his room or something. Like, he didn't carry it around with him. But it was, like, he viewed it as his, like, better fake ID.
So if they were really, like, planning ahead of time that they wanted to conceal their identities, it would have made more sense for Eric to use the Richard Stevens ID, because this was during a time where the technology wasn't such that, like, a store would be able to, like, record an image or, like, take a photo of an image on an ID and then store that. They would, like, just look at the person who was in front of them, like, write their name down on a form, and then they'd be on their way, right? Which is what happened in this case with Donovan Gaudreau's ID. So if they were really planning to conceal their identity, like, that much in advance, why would they use the ID that could just easily be linked back to Lyle? Because it was the ID of Lyle's best friend.
Yeah. And I mean, to me, that kind of goes back to like the whole driving to San Diego thing. Like, if they left LA with the intention of, we're going to try to hide our identities and go to San Diego and buy these guns, why didn't they just bring the Richard Stevens ID with them?
Yeah. And with the Donovan Gaudreau ID as well, like, I mean, even though they say during trial, or Eric says, like, oh yeah, I think I look pretty similar to Donovan. No, he doesn't. Like, I don't understand how anyone could have looked at that ID and then looked at Eric and been like, oh yeah, that's the same person. So I feel like that's another thing where, like, they easily could have been caught out there. Like, if the person just, like, looked more closely at the ID, they would have seen that, oh wait, this is not the same person. But then, like, the explanation for that is because they weren't really thinking that much ahead of time. They were just sort of in a panic and being like, oh shit, we need to buy guns.
There was a part of Eric's therapy session with his therapist in jail, Dr. Vickery, where Eric talked about being worried that Jose would figure out that they had bought guns because he would be getting mail from the NRA, which is like the National Rifle Association, which is like a big group over here of gun owners, basically. So Eric told Vickery that he was worried that Jose would figure out that he had bought a gun because he would be getting this mail. Which, to me, that's just like, if Eric had bought guns because he knew he was going to be killing his father, then his father wouldn't be getting NRA mail. It, to me, just shows he wasn't really thinking that he was going to actually use the gun to kill his father, because he was still thinking about what his father would think.
After visiting the second gun store, they then went to a restaurant afterwards where Eric practiced Donovan's signature so that when they purchased the guns, he'd be able to, like, write it down.
Yeah, and I think they also, like, looked in a phone book because they weren't sure if they needed a local address.
After Eric practiced Donovan's signature at the restaurant and they looked up local addresses, they then went to the third gun store, which was the Big Five, right?
Yeah.
Yes, in San Diego. So then Eric purchased shotguns with birdshot ammo, which was not actually the correct ammo for, like, because, like, birdshot is used for, like, if you're shooting birds, right, because it spreads out more.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Leslie brought up at one point that it was, like, bird hunting season or something, so there was probably just, like, a stack of birdshot ammo in the store, and they just grabbed it.
Like they were on sale or something.
Yeah. Eric was the one who made the purchase. And when he was filling out the paperwork, he forgot the address that he had looked up. So he wrote August Street because it was the month of August. Turns out there actually was an August Street in San Diego, but it wasn't, like, the number that he put didn't exist or something like that.
Yeah, and it wasn't the street that they had looked up.
I just think it's, like, another example of them not being prepared at all. In the first trial, a store clerk from the Big Five in San Diego testified, and she said that she remembered the purchase. From what she remembered, the customer had come in and said, I want two shotguns, and, like, pointed to them and was very, like, confident.
Didn't she have, like, multiple interviews with, like, Zola beforehand where she basically said that she didn't remember it?
When he showed you that form in March 14th of 1990, you told him that you did not remember the sale at all, correct? Right. You had no recollection of who bought the guns, male, female, one, two, what time of day it was, nothing.
Not at the top of my mind, no.
Okay. And you said you didn't remember the driver's license specifically that was used for the sale.
Meaning?
He asked you if you remembered the license that you were shown. Do you remember telling him you didn't?
I don't remember. Yeah, I remember telling him I didn't recall it.
Okay. And do you recall Detective Zoller asking you if the person, the purchaser, who filled out the form resembled the picture on the driver's license?
Yes, I do remember him asking.
And do you remember telling him that you don't remember if he did or not, but you assumed that he did?
Right, correct.
And do you recall that Detective Zoller showed you what are called photo lineup cards.
Correct.
And that's a card that has the pictures of six people on each card?
Correct.
And he showed you two different cards.
Yes.
And you selected a number of a person who you said looked familiar to you, but not in reference to the sale, because you didn't remember the sale. Is that correct?
Correct.
So you're making certain deductions, aren't you, based on who was working what shifts and who else was working at the store. You're sort of deducting your way back to this transaction.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't really remember the person at all, do you?
I don't remember the person as far as looks or anything. I do remember, you know, looking at the transaction, the receipts, who was there. I do vaguely remember parts of the sale, but I can't point out a person per se. And I do know the procedures and what would have went on, so I can say that, you know, yes, I did look at a driver's license, yes, I did write this down, yes, I did ask if this address was correct.
Because you always do that.
I always do that.
All right, so some of it is deduction and some of it is your usual custom and practice. Is
correct.
That right?
Mm-hmm. If you want to say it's deduction, you can say it's deduction.
Okay. Deduction as contrasted with memory.
Right.
You know, maybe she really did remember it. Or maybe she just made it up so she could get on television.
Was it, like, on the drive back, Eric loaded stuff into his gun, right? Or some of the ammo?
Yeah. So they return home, and at some point that evening, Kitty told the brothers that they were going on this boat trip the next day.
And I didn't believe the whole thing. I thought the fishing trip was the way that my dad had designed to take care of us. Kill us. And because originally the idea was that he had lied to this executive guy that he was a deep sea fisherman and he had to do a quick practice session, and that's how this whole thing arose. And he had not expected us to necessarily go with him because I was going to practice tennis and we had a tournament coming up, and he wouldn't have expected me to take 5 hours doing this, but he had to. And now he wanted us along with him. And so we gave my mom a hard time about it, and she said, well, if you don't want to go, you can go up and talk to your dad. And she was very cold about it, and we didn't want to do that, so we just said, oh, we'll go.
Why didn't you want to go talk to your dad about not wanting to go?
Probably should have, but I just didn't want to have a conversation with my dad after Thursday unless he initiated.
Which, like, because they were already afraid and already thinking that their parents were plotting to kill them, it, like, makes sense that they would be like, oh, this is suspicious.
So the next day, which was the Saturday, weren't they, like, already, like, kind of unsure about the ammo that they had?
Yeah.
So then they went to, like, a local gun store where they did ask about ammunition. And then they were told about, like, oh, no, like, if it's, like, for protection or whatever, like, you want buckshot. Not birdshot, because birdshot is a lot less lethal and, well, worse at, like, defending yourself or whatever. But then wasn't that also the place where, like, they said that, like, they wanted to try and practice shooting at a range, but they couldn't because, like, the range didn't allow them to practice using shotguns there?
Yeah.
They had no reason to, like, say that. Like, why does it? Because that makes them look worse, doesn't it? Like, oh, you want to practice shooting your gun, like, before you kill your parents? Like, why would you? I don't know, why say that? That same Saturday was when they knew that there was going to be the boat trip, but because they were afraid at the time, they assumed that, okay, like, maybe if we just, like, stay out long enough and stall for a bit, like, the parents would just go without us because they had already, like, made plans for the trip. Was it that day that, like, they had, like, changed the time of the trip?
Yeah, and the boat captain corroborated that.
Okay, what was the time?
Well, according to that, 11.
And it was changed to what time?
To 3.
And do you remember when that change was? Was it just...
You know, it was most likely that morning. They're kind of slow to get me with that information. It was either that morning or the night before when we started talking about what a good time was to come by.
So the best, when you found out about it, it was within a day or so of when...
That's correct.
Either Friday or Saturday morning.
And they were scheduled for 3 o'clock, and what time did they actually arrive?
They arrived at somewhere between 4 and 4:30. I think probably closer to 4:30. It seems to me they were about an hour and a half late.
So that's one thing that's like, oh, okay, yes, they are telling the truth about that.
Yeah. So they had tried to miss the trip, but when they got back, their parents had waited for them. And so that kind of increased their fear and their thinking that, okay, this trip is a like plot to kill us, basically. And that like something's going to happen on this trip.
Yeah. I remember in Eric Tells All, he speaks about like them being in the car on the way to like the boat trip, and he says that like he felt like he was being driven to his death.
I remember the drive down to the marina. It was complete silence the entire way there. I swear to God, it felt like I was being driven to my grave. I remember seeing the boats and feeling this dread. You know, part of me just wanted to run. The idea of being alone on the ocean with nobody around, I was nervous and paranoid for a good reason. Everything that Mom and Dad had told me, that programmed into my head, that I was in grave danger if I ever told Lyle, all of my life had come true.
It is quite a strange thing. Like, all these things have happened in the past few days, and, like, no one is talking to each other about anything. Like, there's just nothing. No communication.
It's just so, like, sinister, you know?
They go on this boat trip, right? Do you remember, like, a general, like, synopsis of the evening?
Yeah, well, I think they got there at, like, 4 or something. When they got there, it was the boat captain and one other person. And according to the brothers, Kitty seemed surprised that there was another person on the boat.
My mom was upset that there were more people on the boat than she anticipated. I guess she had only expected the boat captain to be there. And I remember thinking, why should she care?
In their mind, she was like, oh, there's another witness, basically. So then they got on the boat, and as soon as they got on the boat, the brothers went to the front of the boat, which was like in view of the captain, and then the parents kind of stayed at the back, away from the brothers.
The son stayed at the front of the boat during the whole charter, the bow of the boat, and it was a very choppy, wet day. And they, upon leaving Marina Del Rey, we actually took a wave over the front of the boat that soaked them. And we were on top of the flybridge, of course, and didn't get wet, and yet we were still cold. And I believe they were wearing shorts. And we couldn't understand why they were staying up there freezing.
Did they appear to be comfortable, or did they appear to be uncomfortable?
They appeared uncomfortable.
And did you tell Detective Zoller about that as well?
Yes, I did.
And when you say they were uncomfortable, could you describe what their behavior was?
They were, they appeared to be very cold and shivering. And so they were very close to each other and right below us, sitting on the bridge of the boat. Okay.
So were they in a position where you could observe them at all times?
I was right over the top of them, yes.
And their father was at the opposite end of the boat?
Yes, he stayed to the rear of the boat.
Did, during the 7 hours that they were on the boat, did you see Lyle Menendez spending time with his father or with his mother? Or would you say the majority of the time was in the front of the boat?
The majority of the time Lyle was in the front of the boat.
And how much time would you say, out of the 7 hours, and how much time would you say he was actually within reaching distance of his father?
Oh, well, I couldn't put a time limit on it, really, but it wasn't very long. There was just very few times that Lyle came back from the front of the boat. You know, when we actually caught the sharks, he did. I believe when we stopped during the last shark fishing part, he came back. But most of the time, Lyle was up front. Very, very, very small amount of time was he with Jose. Or.
And during the times that he was with Jose, those brief times, were there other people around?
Well, Eric and myself, I was almost always down on the deck. and my deckhand.
The one thing is that Kitty was seasick on the trip, so she was kind of spending the time inside the boat. But still, I think this is a super corroborative event for their being afraid and for, like, the weird tension in the family during this time. Because, you know, I think people like to think, like, ooh, they were sitting up at the front of the boat, like, plotting to kill their parents. But if nothing was going on in the family, why didn't Jose try to talk to them?
Yeah, because, like, from everything else we know about the family's history, Jose was, like, glued to the kids. They were always within his sight, and he would always, like, want to know, like, what they were doing, if he was in their presence, right?
Right. And, you know, he was very concerned about the family's public image and, like, how things look to other people. I think even if, like, there was tension in the family, like, a minor issue, Jose wouldn't want other people to know that, because he wanted to give the image of the perfect family. So for there to be this, like, very obvious divide between the parents and the kids, to the point that, like, someone else noticed it, I think that indicates that there was something major going on in the family.
No, I agree with you. It's in Eric Tells All, right, where they interview the boat captain, and he says that, like, when he heard that, like, the parents were killed the next day, like, he instantly was like, oh, it's the sons.
I turned on the television, and broadcast or whatever says, Rich Beverly Hills couple shot to death. And I turned around to my roommate and I said, that's the Menendezes, and the kids shot him.
What made you say that?
I don't know. Weird feeling, night before being so weird.
It's funny that he was a prosecution witness, actually.
Yeah, I think that this trip is an unavoidable piece of evidence that doesn't fit at all with the prosecution's vision of how the crime happened. Because at this point, they had already purchased the guns. So if they had purchased the guns with the intention of killing their parents, then on the boat, they would know that they were going to kill their parents. So why would they be acting so weird? You would think they would try to be acting normally so that this boat captain wouldn't go and say, yeah, there were really weird vibes. It's the kind of thing that I think gets overlooked a lot in the media narrative of the case because it doesn't fit at all with a premeditated crime.
Mm-hmm. So finally, after this, like, 7-hour fishing trip, they finally get back around, it was around, like, midnight, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and after they arrive back, I think they go back to the house, and then Eric and Lyle decide that they just want to, like, drive up to UCLA and, like, talk about stuff and try to figure out, like, what is actually happening in the family.
I didn't understand what they were up to in their own way, and they weren't talking to us and about it. Well, they weren't giving us the signs that I was looking for.
Okay. Well, did you think maybe you were wrong and everything was peachy and there was no problem and life would go on as usual?
No, I wasn't wrong.
They decide then that the next day Eric should try and stay out of the house as much as possible, and that Lyle will stay home and, like, try and get a bit of a gauge on what's happening and try to level with the parents, I think. Like, I think he's trying to communicate with them on some level. At least that's what he plans.
Yeah, I think they had decided that, like, if they were going to be killed, that they would probably both be killed at the same time, so they thought, okay, if we stay apart, then it'll be less likely that they try to kill us.
Yeah. Also, the whole, like, Eric staying out of the house on Sunday as well, there is corroboration for this, and we will get into that in a bit. Anyway, after they spend this time at UCLA, they come back and the doors to the house are locked, and the brothers don't have their own keys, which is another thing which is a bit weird. Like, they're 18 and 21 at this time, and they don't have keys to their own house. Why would that be?
Wasn't that a whole thing that, like, Kitty would tell them, like, it's my house, it's not your house, it's my house, like, you don't get your own keys because you don't own this house, kind of thing?
Yeah, apparently there was testimony about the keys. Maybe it was when Ed Fenner was, like, living with them. He said that, like, the brothers didn't have their own keys, but, like, there would be keys, like, in the kitchen or, like, on a side somewhere. But they were, like, always kept in the house, and the brothers weren't allowed to, like, take them without first getting permission or something. Which is very strange.
Yeah.
Kitty comes down to let them in, and then she tells Eric that if he had kept his mouth shut, things might have worked out in the family.
She told me that if I would have kept my mouth shut, things might have worked out in the family.
What did you think that meant?
That meant that things had not worked out in the family, and I believed that she was going to kill us.
Okay, so that statement added something to what you were already thinking?
Yes.
Did that make you more fearful, less fearful?
Made me a lot more fearful.
So when you went back inside now to actually go up to your room, did you take something with you?
Yes.
What did you take?
The gun.
In the trial, the defense argued that the brothers had, like, incorrectly read the signals from their parents because they were, you know, paranoid and had this history of abuse, but, like, I don't know if they read the signals wrong.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of, I think Leslie talks about this in her closing argument a bit, where it's like, no, they had, like, genuine, like, reason to be afraid at this time. It wasn't unreasonable.
Later that night, Eric was in his room, and Jose, like, starts pounding on his door, telling Eric to let him in. And then Eric, like, got his gun out. I think he had, like, kept it under his bed or something like that. And then he just sat on the bed holding the gun, like, shaking.
He had it, like, across his knees, didn't he?
How long did this go on with your father pounding and yelling?
Maybe a minute.
And what was going through your mind during that minute?
What was going through my mind was he was going to break down the door.
And what were you going to do? Were you thinking, what would you do?
Yeah, I'm...
Wait for the question, please. If he broke down the door.
I was going to shoot. I was just going to shoot.
And did you think you would be able to do that?
I really didn't think I'd be able to.
Why not?
I was just frozen. I was shaking, and I knew what he was going to do. At least I thought he was going to break down the door. And I was saying, I got to shoot him. And I remembered I only had two shells in my gun. And I was saying, oh, my God, I'm going to die. Because if I miss him or if I hit him, Mom's still in the house. Lyle's all the way in the guest house. And I didn't know what was going to happen.
It's kind of a side thing, but I remember, this is the part of, like, Kuriyama's, like, cross-examination where he was like, well, why didn't you, like, ask your brother to, like, stay, like, with you that night if you were that afraid? And it's like, well, if they weren't sure what the parents were doing, wouldn't it have looked really suspicious on their part if, like, Lyle had just decided to stay in the main house?
Didn't you tell the police when you gave them your interview in September of 1989 that you often slept inside of the main house if the guest house bathroom wasn't working?
Right.
Okay, so why didn't you just tell your parents that the guest house bathroom wasn't working and go inside the house to be with your brother who was in mortal danger?
I just didn't do that. I thought that would be the kind of behavior that would be suspicious. It didn't even occur to me, but I doubt I would have, even if it had.
Well, you've indicated that you felt that you were smart enough to do the work at Princeton University, correct?
Right.
Okay. All you would have had to do is do something to the toilet, go inside, take something out of the toilet, go inside the house and say, hey, the toilet's not working, I'm going to stay here, because you were in fear of your life, right?
Well, I mean, we could have done a lot of the things that you're suggesting. I'm just telling you what we did.
Right.
And that didn't occur to me. It would have been a good idea, probably.
I mean, most of the cross-examination was like, why didn't you do this thing instead of this thing?
Yeah.
And, like, part of that was questioning whether their decisions were rational, kind of, or, like, why they made certain decisions during this week.
But I feel like it is the sort of thing where it's like, if you're in that situation and you're thinking, well, I'm pretty sure my parents will kill me if I, like, ever told anyone about this, and I feel like they've threatened my life, but I'm also not sure if they're going to completely. Why would they want to bring their parents down on them faster by, like, showing their parents that, oh, like, okay, they're cooperating with each other?
I mean, I think that their decisions do make sense to a certain extent. Like, based on what we know about their personalities, both, like, the brothers' personalities, but also the parents'. I guess we should probably add that throughout this entire week, neither brother was really sleeping that much, which makes sense because they were extremely paranoid and terrified that their parents were about to kill them.
Actually, I think I've mentioned this before, but that's another thing that I think people forget when it comes to, like, the night of the shooting as well. Like, I can't imagine how sleep-deprived they were, and when people are sleep-deprived, they make the most irrational decisions. On top of, like, everything else that was happening. Like, being severely sleep-deprived probably did not help.
Yeah.
We're on to the Sunday, right?
Yeah. On the Sunday, Eric got up really early, and then he went over to Lyle's guest house, and I guess Lyle was already awake, or woke Lyle up and told him what had happened in his room the night before with Jose, like, pounding on his door. And this kind of just reinforced to the brothers that something is going to happen, like, we need to stay apart today. So Eric then left the house and, like, stayed out of the house the entire day, which there is corroboration for. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah, so the corroboration for, like, Eric just not being in the house that entire Sunday, which is the same night, same day of the killings, is that the last time that Eric saw his tennis coach, Mark Heffernan, he said to Mark, oh, I'll make plans for, like, next week's lessons with you on Sunday. I'll call you. But Eric never actually calls Mark on the Sunday at all until after the parents are killed. And he's calling him for a different reason at that point. But it's a bit of a small thing, but I think it definitely does corroborate that Eric would not have been in the house that day, because obviously cell phones didn't exist back then. So the only way that Eric would have been able to call Mark, like, conveniently, would have been from a house phone.
I think it is just, like, a small thing that you could try to make excuses for it if you're from a prosecution angle. You just be like, oh, Eric forgot that he was calling his coach.
But it is also the sort of thing, though, that's like, well, why would you... Like, if, for example, if you're looking at it from a prosecution point of view, if they were like, okay, we're going to kill our parents on a Sunday night because they know both their parents are going to be home, presumably, why would Eric tell his coach, like, I'll call you on Sunday, knowing that he's going to kill his parents on Sunday, and then not call him? I mean, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like that would sort of set, like, alarm bells ringing to most people. Like, oh, this person told me they were going to call me, but they never did. The same day their parents are murdered.
I mean, I think, like, it's the kind of thing that if the police had been suspicious of the brothers from the beginning, they might have asked Mark, did you notice anything weird that went on with Eric that week or, like, that day or something like that? And then maybe Mark would have been like, oh, yeah, it was kind of weird that Eric didn't call me. Because in the beginning, the police didn't do that kind of questioning. I think a lot of that weird things that happened that week kind of got lost.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Eric leaves for the day, and Lyle, in the morning, he stayed in the guest house, and he called his friend Perry Berman to talk about meeting up later that night, but Perry didn't pick up, so he left him a message. And then later, Perry called back, but he talked to Jose because all of the phones in the house rang to the main line. Each brother had a phone in their room, and there were phones all over the house, but if someone called the phone number, even if they were trying to reach Lyle or Eric, they would call, and it would call to the main house and the main phone. So that's how he ended up talking to Jose.
I'm actually curious how those phones worked, because, like, didn't Kitty, like, record their phone calls or something? Which is another extremely strange thing.
I mean, I would view that as abusive behavior.
Yeah.
Just off the bat, like, that level of privacy invasion on your adult children. Where were we? Oh, so yeah. And Perry called the house and talked to Jose. And Jose told Perry that Lyle was out of the house.
I returned the call, spoke to Mr. Menendez. He told me that Lyle was with Eric, and he believed they were at the Beverly Center shopping.
Okay, so at some point in the afternoon, Lyle decided that he needed to, like, go into the house and try to talk to his parents.
I decided that I would go in and try to just sort of say hello and to see what the atmosphere was like, and I went in and I said hello, and they didn't answer me. And I just kind of stood there, and they were watching TV. And then I was kind of shooken up by that.
Was that unusual for you to speak to them and them to not answer?
Not for my mom, but for my dad it would be unusual. And at some point I tried to talk to my dad again and asked him about if he had the number to that unarmed arbitrage camp in Marina Del Rey.
Why did you ask him about that?
Just to get a response. It was making me, it was just sort of unbearable not to have them say anything at all, and I was feeling like a ghost, like we were already dead. And so I just wanted to talk. And he had, in the past, been kind of bugging me to try that camp, and I had not gone to that camp. And so I asked for the number this time, and he said, "What does it matter anymore?"
Did that have any meaning to you?
Yes, I felt that, well, I could have a lot of meanings, but it just clearly had something to do with the crisis and the Thursday conversation and what had been happening in the house.
What did it mean to you? How did you take that?
I took it to be just my dad's sarcastic way of saying, "You're dead. You're not going to be around to be going to Arnon Armitage camps." And that's the way I took it.
It does add to why there was this like building fear. It's just like another thing that adds on. Lyle calls Perry back in the afternoon.
And was there anything unusual about that conversation?
No, except that, there was something unusual, which was that my dad had lied. He had called at some point after I had left the message.
Who had called?
Perry had called, returning my message, and my dad had lied and said that I was out and that I couldn't do anything that night. Perry had been returning my message about doing something that night. And
your dad had told him that you were out?
Right.
Were you home all day?
Yes.
So did the fact that your dad had told him that you were out when you were home have any meaning for you?
Oh, yes, it had a great meaning.
What did it mean to you?
I felt that something was going to happen that night, and he wanted me home.
That's another bit of the cross-examination I remember from Pam, where she's like, "Well, maybe your dad just didn't think you were home."
Yeah, that was one thing where it gets a little confusing with the whole issue of like what the brothers perceived versus what was actually happening. Like, maybe he wasn't lying. Maybe Jose just actually thought that Lyle wasn't home. But that doesn't really matter because it's all about what Lyle thought Jose was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it shows that Lyle wasn't maybe thinking things through all the way because of this level of paranoia. And he didn't think about, oh, maybe he actually didn't know that I was at home.
Yeah. On this point, though, there is a bit of conflicting or possibly contradicting testimony. Perry Berman, in the second trial, actually changed his testimony. In the second trial, he altered his testimony to say that Lyle had actually told him that, oh, yeah, I was out at the Beverly Center at the mall, rather than it being Jose who told him. But then during cross-examination in the second trial, Leslie Abramson basically got him to admit that, well, actually, I'm not completely sure who told me Lyle was out that day. It could have been Jose, it could have been Lyle. So there is that small bit of information that could possibly contradict their version of events. But it just depends on like whether Perry is misremembering or not. Or whether he's just saying something because someone wants him to say it.
I don't know. I think it's probably likely that Perry just misremembered because if you think about it, like, Perry's role in this is like in determining the brothers' actions before and what they were thinking before the shooting is very important. But to Perry at the time, it was probably so insignificant. I think he probably just was mixing up details.
Yeah. I mean, especially because of the fact that he did not mention this at all during the first trial. And Perry was a prosecution witness in the first trial as well. So it's not as if, like, the defense called him in the first trial and he said this. Prosecution called him second trial and then said this, you know? It's not the sort of thing where, like, oh, of course he would have said that in the first trial because he was testifying for the defense. No, he testified for the prosecution in the first trial, and that's what he testified to.
Yeah, so when Lyle called Perry back, Lyle suggested that they make plans to meet up later that night.
And what was the nature of that conversation?
That Lyle wanted to get together that evening, and I told him that I had plans to go to the Taste of L.A., which is a food festival at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. And I was going with a friend of mine, and then he was more than welcome to join us. We know with Eric, of course.
And how did he respond to that?
He said that he had plans with Eric to go to see Batman, the movie Batman.
And did you agree to meet sometime later
that
night?
Oh, yes. Lyle said that he would come after the movie was over, that the two boys, Lyle and Eric, would go to the Taste of L.A. around 9:30 that evening.
And this is a very important part of the conversation because this is often what's referred to as, like, Lyle creating an alibi.
I feel like that in itself, though, sort of defeats, like, the objective, though, because why do you make plans to see someone at 9:30 and then kill your parents at, like, after 10? Say, for example, if it was, like, premeditated and planned. It gets to 9:30, you're still at your house, and you're like, let's wait 30 more minutes, then kill our parents, and then we won't even try to contact Perry for another hour.
Because he's literally creating someone who can then say, well, Lyle didn't meet up with me. Because otherwise, if Lyle didn't make these plans, then there would be no one to say he was supposed to be somewhere and then he didn't show up.
Like, usually, like, when we get negative comments on our videos, something that I've noticed that people pick out is the fact that we say, well, why didn't they do this? Or this would have made more sense if they did this, but, like, we're not criminals or something like that. But I feel like in this example, like, I just don't understand how you can view this as, like, a planned alibi, because they're supposed to meet this person at 9:30. The parents are not dead until at least after 10. Like, people always generalize it to 10 p.m, but it's probably, like, 10 past 10 or quarter past 10 or something like that, roughly. So that's, the parents are dead, like, 45 minutes after you're supposed to meet someone, and then you don't meet that person at all on that night, and you don't contact him until 11 p.m. I just don't understand how anyone could look at that and be like, yeah, like, they planned for Perry to be an alibi, and they just killed their parents anyway, even though he's not an alibi anymore. I feel like that's one piece of evidence that gets construed as, like, being pro, like, it's, that helps the prosecution, but I don't think it does.
The prosecution says that this was an attempted alibi, where Lyle was like, I'm gonna make these plans knowing that I'm going to be killing my parents that night, and then Perry can say that I was there. But I think what contradicts that is that there's no evidence that Lyle ever tried to get Perry to say he had actually been at the wine festival. The thing with an alibi is that if you are actually the perpetrator, you can't have an alibi because you committed the crime. But if you were like, I'm going to commit a crime at a certain time, I'm going to try to get someone to say that I was somewhere else and therefore I couldn't be the person committing the crime, then you would think that there would be evidence that Lyle tried to get Perry to lie and say, oh yeah, Lyle did meet me at 9:30, so he couldn't be the one to be the murderer because he was with me. If this was Lyle's attempt to create an alibi for himself, then afterwards he would say to Perry, Perry, just say I was there.
Yeah. What we're about to go into next, I think, further defeats the notion that this was an alibi, and that is the information that comes from Lyle during his testimony about, I think, someone who's a friend that he made through, like, physiotherapy called Carrie Parker. Like, either the week before or sometime before, they had already made plans to go to the movies to watch Batman on the Sunday night,
Now, when did you make arrangements to go to the movies with Carrie Parker?
Earlier in the week, like either Monday or Tuesday, something in there.
And so you had plans to go to the movies with Carrie Parker to see Batman.
Well, he had never seen it, and I had already seen it, and he wanted to see it again. And earlier in the week before this whole thing happened, I told him I'd go with him. So we arranged to meet at the movies that night to go see Batman, and I was willing to see with him again. And so I just kept those plans.
And the fact that your parents were about to kill you didn't cause you to cancel your plans with Carrie Parker, is that correct?
No, I thought it was the exact opposite. I was glad that we had the plans, and I had told Eric, let's go to the movies with Carrie Parker and be with somebody and be safe.
Anyway, like, he was supposed to go and watch Batman on this Sunday at 8 p.m. So he has one person who is supposed to meet him at 8. He doesn't ever meet that person. He has another person at 9:30. He never meets that person. Doesn't contact him until 11. So that's two people already who can say, Lyle was supposed to meet me on the night that his parents were killed and he didn't show up. So he was obviously somewhere else doing something else.
Carrie never testified or anything like that.
Yeah.
Eric had planned to be out of the house all day, but then he was planning to get back right around the time that the brothers would have to go to meet Carrie Parker at the movie theater. But Eric was late getting home.
Did you get home late that night or later that night?
Yes.
Did you get home later than you had told your brother you would?
Yes.
And what was it, what feeling, if any, kept you from getting home earlier?
I just didn't want to be at home, and I just really didn't want to have contact with my dad.
Why? What were you feeling?
I was scared, and I was supposed to meet home around 7:30 or 8 or something like that, and I didn't get home till much later.
But this, like, timing thing as well is another thing that sort of, like corroborates, like, why they never would have contacted Carrie, because they were late to the movies. Why were they late to the movies? Because Eric was out all day and he was late getting home.
Yeah, so Eric is late getting back, and when he gets back, Lyle tells him about what happened that day. And Lyle says to Eric, like, we have to get out of the house. I was reading the signals and I'm still freaked out.
Yeah, the fear was growing and it just sort of was getting out of control for me. And I was feeling very, crumbling. And the night before, after my mom had said that, I felt like things were sort of, I was not in control. I was sort of slipping away, and I was trying to be, I was trying to help my brother by being not as hysterical as he was and trying to say that things were going to be all right, and I was losing that. And especially since my dad lied about me being home, I felt that something was going to happen Sunday, and I was scared, and I wanted to get out of the house.
So then the brothers go into the house to tell their parents that they were leaving.
Yeah, I mean, didn't they say that it was partially because of, like, they just didn't want to, like, make their parents think that they were, like, running off anywhere or something? They were just like, no, we're just going to the movies. We're not going far.
Yeah. It's like they didn't want it to seem suspicious. And so they went and told their parents they were leaving because that's what they always did.
Like, as they're about to leave, though, and they're standing in the foyer, I think it is, the parents, like, come out, and I think Kitty starts, like, maybe she had been drinking, or she starts stammering a bit, and she's like, no, you can't leave.
I heard my mom saying that Lyle and I couldn't go out, and Lyle asking mom why can't we go out, and her saying because she started to stutter, she didn't answer.
And was there anything about that you thought was noteworthy or important?
Yeah, I started to get the chills right then.
Why?
Because they were saying we couldn't go out, and that means that we were going to have to be in the house with them alone, and I didn't like that. I was already having a bad feeling, and I was having a worse feeling right then.
And I think this is kind of when they start to think, okay, maybe our parents are planning to kill us tonight. So then Jose comes out and tells Eric to go up to his room, and he'll be there in a minute.
What did you think your father had in mind when he first said, get up to your room, I'll be there in a minute?
I had two things in my mind.
When he first said it, this is before the argument with your brother.
Well, I knew what he was saying.
What, in your opinion, was he saying?
That he was going to come up to my room and have sex with me. That's what he always did when he said that.
And would he mean that for various kinds of sex, or just one kind, or what?
For various kinds, but it really depended on how angry he was. Sometimes he said, go up to your room, and I'll be there in a few minutes. Sometimes he said, go to your room, and I'll be there in a minute. And you could tell by the tone of his voice, or how angry he was, what type he was going to have.
What type did you think he was threatening you with when he first said, get up to your room on Sunday night?
Sex.
And over the past 3 years or so of your life, was what you call sex something that was done in anger or something that was done more neutrally by your father?
It was done in anger.
So Eric starts going upstairs because that's what he's been, like, conditioned to do.
Then this is, like, where the big confrontation happens, right?
How did Lyle respond after your father gestured and said that you were to get up to your room?
He said, no, you're not going to touch Eric. I think he looked at me and told me to get back down the stairs, but I just specifically remember him saying to Dad, you're not going to touch my little brother, you're not going to touch Eric, you're never going to touch him again, that kind of a thing. I just remember him saying that because I remember thinking to myself, you know, Lyle, what are you doing? Are you crazy? Don't get into an argument right now, right here. And I was just sort of going up the stairs real slowly.
When your brother said to your father, you're not going to touch Eric, you're not going to touch my little brother again, did your father respond?
Yes.
And can you tell us first, what kind of tone of voice did your father respond in?
He just jumped at Lyle. He came right over him, and he said, I do what I want in my family. It's not your little brother, it's my son. And he just was real yelling at him, real jumping at him.
When you say he came right over him, did he move towards
him? Yeah, he walked right toward him, as if, you know, ready for a fight. And I could not believe what was happening.
How did Lyle respond when your father came towards him?
He just moved back and he said, no, you're not going to touch Eric. And I said, oh, Jesus.
Okay, wait a minute. Lyle backed up when your father came towards him?
Yeah, whenever Dad came toward Lyle, Lyle always got timid and went away.
Got timid?
Yeah, you could tell by his face.
When your father made this statement to Lyle, what did Lyle say, if anything, in return?
Lyle just said, no, you're not going to touch him. But his voice was a lot weaker.
Did Lyle say anything about still wanting you to go out with him or wanting to leave?
He may have said, we're leaving. And my dad just, when he started, he doesn't really stop. He just, it's like a rush of wind. It's like a hurricane. He just, and he just said, no, he's my son. I say what I want in this family. He's not your little brother. You're not going out tonight. And Lyle was saying, no, you're not going to touch him. And he said, don't tell me what to do. And he was coming closer. And he just ended it by telling me to go back up to my room because I was sort of lingering on the stairs.
So I guess, like, in usual, like, Jose fashion, he's like, when the argument is done to him, like, it's done to him.
My dad left, went in the den, and my mother was sort of still standing there and said something to me about that I had ruined the family. And I was just not saying anything. And then my dad came out and took her by the arm and said, come on, kitty. And they walked into the den, and then my dad closed the doors.
And to the brothers, like, this was like a big sign. Well, they sort of like made it seem that way in their testimony, right? Like, it was like the closing of the den doors.
I was sure that that was it. They were in the den, and my dad had closed the doors, and I didn't believe that dad was going to finish any movie or talk to Eric. I thought he was just buying time, and I realized that they had been waiting for Eric to get home. like I had been. And I just freaked out.
What did you think they were doing in the den? What did you think was going to happen?
I thought they were going ahead with their plan to kill us.
I think this is even in Norman Novelli's tapes, right? Where when Lyle is talking about that night, he says that, like, my parents never shut the doors. It set them off, basically.
Yeah, I think, like, both the parents closing the doors and also the kind of culmination of this argument made Lyle snap. And Lyle is kind of lost, like, rational thought. I don't know. Do you kind of view it similarly?
Yeah, I'd say I view it in a similar way. Because, like, the defense's argument was that it was a killing done under the state of fear. And I think that is true to an extent, but I also think that there were a lot of other emotions that were involved as well.
Especially from Lyle's part.
Yeah. I mean, at this point as well, it's like Eric isn't doing anything, apparently. He's just sort of chilling on the stairs. Like, he's just standing there watching all of this. And that's when, like, Lyle runs up to him and then says, it's happening now.
I ran upstairs to tell my brother that it was happening now and that they were going to, this was it, and they were going to kill us. And I met him at the top of the stairs. He hadn't gone in his room. And I remember sort of being surprised by the fact that he was at the top of the stairs. And I said something to him along those lines that it's happening and they're going to kill us.
Which I think that's pretty significant. Because I don't think Eric would have done anything, like, if not for that.
And it was Lyle running up to him and saying, it's happening now, that made Eric realize that he wasn't just going to wait. He had to do something. Like, they had to do something or else they were going to die.
Yeah.
So then the brothers go to each of their, like, rooms where they have their guns. They get their guns and they bring them to the car. Because they had bought the new ammunition that they learned was better, so they frantically were trying to unload the birdshot and reload with the buckshot. And then they run back into the house.
My brother got there first, and we just burst through the doors, and I started firing.
Wasn't it during this time when, what did Eric say, like, he only had, like one or two thoughts that were going through his head at the time? Oh wait, that was it. Is that the only thing that was going through his head at the time is that he was saying, like, hurry, 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 and that he was scared that when he went in the room that his dad was going to take the gun from him.
So we did a whole episode on the shooting and how the brother's story is corroborated by the physical evidence at the scene and the coroner's report. So we're not going to go too much into that, but there's a few things that we wanted to touch on. So there was mixed ammunition found at the scene, both birdshot and buckshot, and this corroborates the brothers' story about how they were frantically unloading and reloading their weapons in this panicked state, because if they had planned it all out in advance, you would think they would have loaded their weapons with the buckshot, which was the more powerful ammunition. The other thing that corroborates their story is that Kitty had a birdshot wound to her head that was a contact wound, and the brothers testified that this was the shot that they reloaded, where Lyle and Eric had run out to the car because they heard and saw Kitty moving, and Eric grabbed a random shell and gave it to Lyle, and Lyle ran back in and shot Kitty. The fact that this shot was birdshot kind of corroborates the brothers' story that they were just frantically grabbing any shell that they could.
So then after the shooting happens, the brothers, I think, like most people would assume, okay, there's houses all around us. It's just late at night. It's not at a time where people would be asleep. There could be people walking past our house. Someone would have heard this and is going to call the police. So they sit next to each other on the stairs and they're sort of just waiting there for maybe 5 minutes for the police to arrive. And then after these, like, 5 minutes have passed, they realize, oh wait, no one's actually coming. Like, there's no sirens, no nothing. It's just silent. So then they think to themselves, well, I can't remember the way Lyle described it. I think he said, like, he didn't want to have to go to jail, like, if he didn't have to. It's kind of hard. I think it's really hard to describe, like, what someone probably feels like after something like that, and after the whole week's events. But I can sort of imagine being in that state. Well, you thought your parents were going to kill you, so then you ended up killing them. No one's going to actually believe what we say about what happened. Maybe we just don't have to say anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you remember what the initial, like, thing was? What their initial conversation was?
I think they just kind of realized that they were screwed because they had these plans that they didn't make. Like, they didn't go meet the people that they said they were going to meet that night. So they tried to frantically cover their tracks.
Yeah.
I think it makes sense that they would try to do that. I think a lot of people say, like, why didn't they just tell the police? Like, why didn't they just say what had actually happened?
I don't think it's realistic for people to say, well, why didn't they just, like, call the police up and be like, hey, this happened. They probably knew it themselves. This is such, like, a weird, like, our family is really messed up. This has happened this week. There is no way anyone is ever going to believe us. Especially when they've had a dad their entire life, like, reinforced to them over and over again. If you tell anyone, no one's going to believe you anyway. There is no way that Eric or Lyle would have thought, oh yeah, we're just going to call the police and they're going to believe us. In their heads, they thought, like, if the police know we did this, we're going to prison for the rest of our lives. And that's it. I think that's as simple as it is. And I think in that sort of circumstance, I think people don't want to admit it, but I think most people probably would make at least some sort of feeble attempt to, like, not have to confess initially.
And also, I mean, like you said, they've been raised by parents who taught them that they shouldn't trust anyone. And so how are we to expect that they would, you know, suddenly be like, oh, okay, we can trust that the police will help us, when they've been taught that they can only rely on themselves?
So the first thing that they end up doing is that, I think, is probably the most obvious thing, is like, oh, like, we need to pick up the shotgun shells from the room.
Why were you going to pick up the shells?
Because of fingerprints. It's probably... sounds like my idea. But, I don't really know. So we... and I don't really remember picking them up too well, but we did pick them up.
Did you go back into the room where your parents were?
Yes. And we turned on the lights.
Did you look at your parents?
I didn't.
Do you have any memory of seeing what your parents looked like that night after you shot them?
Just from one or two of the photos.
But do you remember it from seeing them?
No.
Did you look at them?
No.
So you picked up the shells?
We picked up the shells and somehow we ended up getting all of them, apparently. But I really wasn't too sure about the idea of whether it would matter to pick up the shells with fingerprints. So we did it pretty hurriedly. So I remember being surprised later that there were no shell casings at all.
Which is another thing that is brought by Dr. Burgess in her testimony, is that, well, they didn't use gloves. Like, if you were planning on killing someone, you would use gloves so that you wouldn't get fingerprints on shells.
Yeah, I think there was a whole thing brought up by the prosecution that maybe they had decided to pick up the shells because they thought it could be traced back to the guns that they used. But I don't think that's a great argument, because it's pretty obvious that the brothers didn't really know that much about the weapons they were using. Wearing gloves or using a weapon that didn't leave shells would have solved that problem if this was planned out.
Yeah. So anyway, after this, they leave the house, and then, like, each brother remembers the order of the next events differently, right?
Yeah, so they decided that they needed to do two things before they went to try to meet Perry. They needed to get rid of the guns, and they needed to go to the movie theater to get, like, physical tickets to show that they had actually been somewhere. I think this often gets brought up as, like, proof that they planned it beforehand, but I think it makes a lot of sense that this would be something that Lyle would think about, or that the brothers would think about doing, because they already had these movie theater plans that they didn't make. So, if you're in this state of, like, what do we do to show that we were somewhere else? Oh, we were supposed to go to the movies. Let's just go try to say that we were doing that.
Yeah. And I think it's also the case where we're like, if Carrie did see them there when they were trying to buy movie tickets, like, they would have someone who could say, well, oh, well, I did see them, but they just appeared, like, slightly later.
Right. Well, they first tried to buy License to Kill tickets because they knew that their friend was at the Batman movie and could say, oh yeah, they weren't at that movie with me.
Now, when you spoke to the police, you told the police that it was your intention to go see License to Kill, but License to Kill was sold out.
Right.
So was that a lie?
That was a lie because I thought that they might talk to Carrie Parker and then he would say that I didn't show up at the movies. And I was afraid that that was going to happen because I hadn't shown up. So what I did was say that I went to see License to Kill and it was sold out. And I saw Batman and just hope that they hadn't talked to him. And then if I saw Carrie, I was just going to say that I went to see License to Kill and I'd missed him.
So you thought all this out in the period of time after you killed your parents but before you went and talked to the police. You thought of all the ramifications of what you were going to say. Is that correct?
Well, there weren't many ramifications. We had decided that we were going to say we were at the movies and that I had had plans to go to the movies with Carrie, so I thought, well, that's what we would just say, that we went to the movies and hoped that this guy didn't come forward or they didn't find him, because I knew that he would say that I didn't show up.
So they tried to get tickets to the James Bond movie, License to Kill. But then they couldn't get License to Kill tickets, so, because it was sold out. And then they couldn't get Batman tickets because the movie was almost already over. So they bought tickets for the next movie, but the tickets had the time on them. And the time was past the time that they needed for the alibi, so they threw the tickets out. I think just the fact that they didn't have movie tickets to produce, I think indicates a lack of planning, as Dr. Burgess would say.
Then the next part of their, like, post-crime actions was them trying to dump the guns. And they went up to, was it called Mulholland Drive?
Yeah, it's like a pretty, I would say it's a famous street in L.A. with, like, it goes through a very, like, wooded, kind of hilly area. Not wooded, like, with trees, but more just, like, bushes and brambles and stuff. They took the guns and I think Eric got out of the car and threw the guns kind of off, kind of down the hill, and then covered them up with brambles and dirt and sticks and stuff like that.
Hey, after this, they then end up at a gas station where they change their clothes. And, like, Eric, like, had, like, a bunch of, like, random clothes in the back of his car, right? Just anyway.
Like, tennis clothes and stuff.
Yeah. And they had noticed that, like, I think Lyle said that he didn't notice any, like, blood on his clothes, right? But then Eric noticed, like, these, like, red dots on his pants, right?
Yeah. I think Lyle said he had blood spots on his shoes. So they just changed and dumped their clothes with the blood spots on them in a dumpster. They ended up getting to this wine tasting festival at around 11 o'clock.
I mean, when they arrived at the Taste of LA, like, Perry had already left, right?
Yeah, because they were an hour late to meet, or over an hour late to meet him.
Yeah, so there goes their supposed alibi.
First of all, you waited at the Taste of LA in Santa Monica until about 10:15
yes.
at night?
Yes.
And you're with your friend Todd Hall?
That is correct.
Okay, and you didn't see Lyle Menendez or his brother Eric that whole night at the Taste of LA?
No.
I think then Lyle goes to like a, what do you call them? Like a street phone or?
A payphone.
Payphone, that's it. And then attempts to call Perry from there at around 11:15 p.m.
Lyle, you know, I asked him what happened to him, and he said basically they got lost and they got there later than they anticipated. He was, at that point, he said he was calling from the Taste of LA, and he wanted to get together that evening. And I told him that I was getting ready to go to sleep. I had work the next morning. And, you know, I'd prefer to wait to Monday or Tuesday night to have dinner or, you know, a bite to eat or something like that. And he was very persistent that he wanted to get together that evening to, you know, discuss his plans to go back to Princeton University in the fall and to talk about his tennis game.
He had to meet you that night?
Yes.
Did he tell you where he wanted
to meet? I basically said, fine, you know, if it's that important to you, we can meet at the Cheesecake Factory in Beverly Hills, which from West Hollywood is maybe a 10-minute drive. And I told him I would meet him there in about a half an hour, which meant it would be like 11:45.
This phone call to Perry at 11:15 was the next time that the brothers could be placed somewhere after the shots were heard. So everything between, you know, around 10 p.m. when the neighbors eventually told police that they heard these shots and 11:15 when this phone call was made is all from what the brothers said happened. It was timed out by the defense that all the things that the brothers said happened could have happened in the time frame that they said it happened in.
Perry, in his testimony, said that, like, Lyle sounded anxious during this time. But this was also during the time where, like, Eric was, like, starting to get emotional about everything. And I think probably Lyle as well. And I remember Lyle saying at this specific time that he just didn't want to be near Eric.
I was feeling a distance from Eric for some reason. I remember feeling like what we had done was really bad and feeling real dirty about it or just kind of bad. And that my brother was bad also. And just not wanting to be, you know, the blood on his pants and just not, he was no comfort for me. It was more like reminding me, and I was trying to think about what was coming. And I felt like Perry, I needed somebody there, and other than my brother, who was really just a mess.
So then I think they ended up deciding that meeting Perry at the Cheesecake Factory, like, was not going to go well. So they just decided to get back to the house.
Lyle called Perry back.
I hung up the phone with him. He called back a few minutes later, within 5 minutes, and asked if it'd be better if I came by the house in Beverly Hills because Eric wanted to pick up like a phony ID so he could, you know, so if he wanted to have a few cocktails, he would be able to. And I told him that I was not going to go by the house, that it was late, and I just said, I'll give you an additional 5 minutes, pick up the ID, and then I would meet him, you know, at the Cheesecake Factory.
Did you then go to the Cheesecake Factory?
Yes.
Did you ever see him that night?
No.
So then the brothers drive back to the house, and at this point they're both starting to like lose control emotionally. They get back, and that's when they make the 911 call.
Called the police?
Call the police.
Is that the 911 tape that's been played here in court?
Right.
And on that tape, you're crying?
Yes.
Is that real?
Yes.
Why were you crying?
Why?
What was upsetting you?
Just the shock. Just not believing that this was happening to me. And that my parents were dead. And that I was about to call the police. And it's really hard to describe the weekend and the stress and the fear and nervousness and caving in feelings. I was really marginal throughout as it got closer to what actually happened. And by then, I was just really raw and just crying for crying's sake. I don't know, crumbling.
And that's kind of when the police investigation starts, which is what we went over in our first episode of this series.
That's basically it.
That's the brother's story of why they killed their parents. There are some inconsistencies, but at the end of the day, I think their story provides reasonable doubt that they planned to kill their parents.
Yeah. I think I agree with that. That's how I see it as well. At the end of the day, I think the defense raised a huge reasonable doubt, and their version of events has enough corroboration to raise that doubt on whether or not the killing of their parents was actually premeditated or not. I feel like a lot of what happened in the last week is either corroborated or makes sense in the context of the family.
Yeah. You know, we've tried to talk about some of the little things that corroborate their story and some of the things that don't corroborate their story. And I think that, you know, it's possible that things happened differently than they said they did. And obviously the brothers have a huge incentive to lie about certain things because, you know, they were on trial for their lives. But to me, enough things line up with what they said happened that makes it believable to me. I do think there were a lot more emotions going on in their head about things that were happening. Like, we talked a little bit about, like, I don't think that Lyle was entirely motivated by fear. I think there was probably a lot of anger towards his parents, but that doesn't change the fact that I don't think it was planned. I don't think that this crime should be considered first-degree murder.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I don't know if this sounds bad, regardless of whether it was planned or not, sort of, putting that in quotation marks, to whatever extent, because of, the emotions that were going on and, the events and, their whole background and the history of the family and what the context of the family was, I think there was enough there to sort of lower their mental state to be one where their actions were motivated through a combination of emotions, and to an extent they were provoked. And so that's why I don't see it as even if it was proved beyond a reasonable doubt that it was planned, that's why I still would not view it as murder. It's like the Jacob Eyne case. In that case, there is undeniable proof that, he planned to kill his parents. But I don't view that as murder. I would say voluntary manslaughter. Because I think, in that situation, someone like that is pushed to a certain point where, in their brain, they think, if I don't kill this person, I'm going to die. I also say, I think maybe my views are a bit skewed as well, because I'm not from the US, and, criminal justice is just different here.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that's really interesting about this case is that I think that the abuse in itself should bring it down from first degree murder, but I don't really apply that to this case because I have determined that I believe what they said about what led up to it. So if my process for concluding in my own head that I believed this story pretty much completely was that I would go to certain points in this week and say, okay, let's say they decided at this point we're going to kill our parents on Sunday. Their actions over the next period of time leading up to that don't really make sense if you find a point in the week and say they decided they were going to kill their parents here. Everything leading up to the killings doesn't line up with someone's actions who was thinking, I'm going to kill my parents at this time. Yeah.
On that same line of thought as well, there's enough in those last few days which I think contradicts a planned killing as well.
in so many documentaries that are made about this case, either like reporters or the narrator, someone says something like, well, you know, two sons don't just decide to kill their parents, so something must have happened in that family.
Something happened in that house. I did not believe for one second that those boys were making it up. The emotion was too real. Now, was that an excuse to murder your parents? No. But did I believe them? Yes.
Do you really kill your parents that brutally for money that you already had access to? No matter how you look at it, this is a family that disintegrated into a horribly violent end. If that was an idyllic childhood and an idyllic household, it wouldn't have ended the way it ended. Something caused it to end that way. And that will always be the thing that people wonder.
So to me, it comes down to like, okay, something happened, right? What if it's what the brothers said happened? That to me is kind of the what I have to keep going back to for myself.
Yeah.
Something like this doesn't happen for no reason. And their story is consistent enough that it makes sense that this would be the something that happened. Thanks for listening, everyone. We really appreciate you all tuning in. We've got some important stuff to cover in our next episode, so stay tuned.